right whale protection, and Maine's lobster fishery. Maine's lobster fishery faces new regulations that go into effect next month, designed to protect the endangered North Atlantic right whale. The regulations issued by the federal agency NOAA close a significant part of the offshore lobster fishery from October to January. Regulators believe this will help reduce the risk that whales might be entangled in lobster fishing gear. But many believe the regulations unfairly target the wrong industry and blame ship strikes and changing climate patterns for killing more right whales. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Maine's Commissioner of Marine Resources and many others working on this issue about what it all means. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. There are new federal protections for endangered right whales right now, and among them, restrictions on Maine lobster fishermen who fish offshore in a certain area of federal water. This area will now be closed from October through January. The rules aim to prevent whales from getting entangled in fishing line. We're going to learn about these controversial regulations and what impact they will have. Joining me for the hour, Commissioner Pat Kelleher with Maine's Department of Marine Resources, and we are also going to hear from several others involved in this issue. We invite your questions and comments. Send a very brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling. You can find us on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We expect this to be a very packed and very popular program, so please keep your comments brief. Before we talk with Commissioner Kelleher, we have Maine Public Reporter Fred Bever on the line, who has been covering this issue and covering fisheries in general for several years now. Fred, thanks so much for calling in, and give us a sense here. What's at stake?
Well, Jen, for the whales, it's a matter of survival and even potential extinction. And for the lobstermen, it's a question of survival, well, at least for lobstering as we know it now. The industry faces a major transformation over the next decade and possibly a significant shakeout.
Tell me more about the whales. What is the situation for the whales? How many are left, and what are we looking at, the issues facing them, the challenges confronting the whale population, the right whale population?
Well, they face a few threats. Ship strikes are a serious problem. They can also get entangled in rope that fishermen use to haul fixed gear like crab or lobster traps. The rope can cut into their flesh. It slows them down. It can cause them to slowly starve to death. Their numbers have sort of fluctuated in recent decades, but starting around 2015, a new period of rapid decline started. There are fewer than 340 of them believed to be alive on the planet now. And climate change might be at the bottom of, or at least part of the picture, Jennifer. Scientists say that the availability of their staple food, it's a tiny little crustacean, it's changing in response to ocean temperatures and changes in the currents. So the whales, they're ranging into new areas, and the regulations may not be so well aligned to protecting them in the new habitats that they're occupying. And under the Endangered Species Act, lobstermen now face new federal regulations that aim to bring down the risk of entanglement by 60% in the short term. And for the industry, this is the scariest part, by 98% within a decade. So, and that's driven to some degree by lawsuits from conservationists, but also just sort of the creaky workings of federal regulatory systems. But now lobstermen will need to add more traps to each buoy line they use. The idea there is that more traps per rope line means less rope in the water. There would be new gear marking required. And finally, more than 960 square miles of fishing grounds, about 30 miles off of Maine, roughly from Stonington down to Booth Bay, it'll be off limits to traditional rope and buoy gear. And that starts this October, and it'll go through January, and that will happen every year going into the future.
I know we're going to be talking a lot this hour about this whole concept of risk reduction, but before we let you go, Fred, I know you just returned from a reporting trip to Stonington. We're talking with lobstermen and others there. What are you hearing from lobstermen? What did they say to you?
Well, it's first of all, Stonington's an amazing place. More than 300 boats fish out of there. These big boats, which some of the lobstermen have taken out big banknotes to finance, they can fish way offshore year round, keep the revenues coming in. They're going to be affected. Many of them are going to be affected by this new restriction. And I heard a range of responses, from mild exasperation and acceptance to anger, some near defiance, particularly amongst more of the younger guys. There's expectations that there could be conflict when they have to move out of that area and sort of elbow along with lobstermen who are in their own traditional fishing territories. But others who I spoke to, particularly guys who tend to fish close to shore, there's more sort of grudging acceptance. There's some anger, but some just sort of, you know, this is fishing life. You know, there are ups and downs, and you got to move with it. But there's also sort of a sense of, from some people, you know, it's time to look for other things. It's time to maybe move on or downsize, diversify what I'm doing, even retire. There's sort of a sense that the true boom times may be over, and there's a lot of concern over what's coming down the pike even after these regulations.
Well, Fred, I look forward to hearing your reports on Maine Public Radio. Thanks so much for taking some time to call in today. That is Fred Bever, a news reporter here at Maine Public Radio. Commissioner Kelleher, I'm sure you're hearing the same kind of comments from lobstermen. And you have said on here on Maine Public Radio that one of your biggest concerns is this increased pressure and potential conflict in these fishing grounds, that if boats are being moved out of these grounds into other fishing grounds, that we may see conflict. Is that still your biggest concern at this point?
Good morning, Jennifer, and thank you for inviting me to Maine Calling. Fred really captured the highlights of what's being heard right now, and that is one of my major concerns associated with a closed area, is the conflict that's going to be created as upwards of 150 licensed harvesters are going to have to move outside of that area to find new bottom. And there's not a lot of bottom on the coast of Maine offshore that during the good part of the migration, as lobsters are moving, that's not being fished. So it's going to be a challenge, and it's certainly going to be a challenge for our Maine Marine Patrol dealing with kind of those social components of gear conflict.
We're now joined by U.S. Senator Angus King. Senator King, thank you so much for joining us.
Jennifer, thanks for letting me. And I want to echo what Pat said, that the Fred Bever's report was really good. The one thing that Fred didn't mention, however, is that the significant majority of whale mortalities in recent years have been in Canadian waters. And that's where the real problem seems to lie, with both strikes and entanglements with crab gear up there. The problem with this response, from my point of view, is it's not based on a lot of evidence or data. There hasn't been an entanglement with Maine lobster gear since 2004, and yet this is where the concentration of the response is. It's like declaring war on Brazil after Pearl Harbor. I mean, we want a strong response, but it's the wrong target. And that area that they're putting off limits is about 1,000 square miles, as Fred mentioned, and it's going to create a lot of problems. The estimate, even of the feds, is that it could cost between 5% and 10% of the overall value of the lobster fishery. And then there are a lot of other problems that are going to cause lobstermen to have to even perhaps double the number of ropes that they have, and have different markings for different areas. So again, everybody wants to protect the whales. The question is whether what's been proposed here will really do anything to protect the whales, but there's also an endangered species of Maine lobstermen along the coast.
Sure. And Senator King, you know, talking about that, whether or not this was the right thing to do, the rules are going to go into place next month. And I'm wondering, seeing that one of the biggest concerns is that the fishing boats displaced by these rules may move into other fishing areas. I'm wondering, what about compensation for them, for their loss? Is there any federal action, any federal momentum for incentivizing these boats to simply not fish during this period? Is there any support in Congress for compensation for them to not fish, or other kind of help for them?
Well, the last several years, there have been a variety of provisions that have provided support to the lobster industry and other parts of the Maine maritime industry, as well as agriculture and others. So there we may well end up with some specific relief. The other problem that I know Pat is well aware of, if the boundaries, if the prohibition stops at the end of January, there's going to be a gold rush into that area. There's going to be another area for conflict. And again, the question that you really have to come back to, and I'll never forget going to a hearing in Ellsworth where the NOAA people were there, and they basically said, well, we think this is where the whales are, but we haven't really done that many flights over the Maine coast, and we really don't know. And that's what really bothers me about this. You're imposing a very severe penalty on an industry based upon very slight evidence. In a court of law, you'd need a lot more evidence before you took an action like this. That, again, the problem is Canada. That's where the administration should be focusing. And I was at a dinner with the Canadian ambassador recently and raised this issue. I think the administration should be really pressing Canada, because it's just not fair to impose these restrictions that are going to hurt our folks and not target where the real problem seems to be.
Commissioner Kelleher, what at this point does Maine and does Maine's lobster fishery need from Congress? What would you like to ask Senator King right now?
Thanks. And the senator in his comments are spot on. We've had really good conversations with Senator King's office, Senator Collins' office, all the members of the delegation around finding some ways to compensate, in particular for the gear marking component. We the state of Maine, got ahead of gear marking. And frankly, they pulled a fast one on us by creating additional requirements to gear marking. And then the timing of those gear markings become operationally difficult. And so the timing couldn't be worse. So we're working with the offices right now to try to find a way to create some compensation for the cost of gear, switching over to a second set of end lines. Later today, I'm expecting that the governor will be sending a letter to the Secretary Raimondo around some different points around finding ways to mitigate for revenue loss and to compensate for the need for additional gear. So there's going to be two fronts here, both with the delegation and the administration.
Senator King.
Well, I think Pat has said, I'm delighted we're going to hear from the governor. This has been, and again, I want to emphasize that I don't know if no one in the delegation nor the governor is unconcerned about the fate of the right whale. I mean, that's the problem. And yet what we want to do is be sure that the measures taken to protect the right whale truly will do so and are targeted at the right place. And right now it appears to be Canada. Fred mentioned the effect of climate change. And one of the effects seems to be that the right whale's food supply, and therefore the whales, are moving north and east. And that's where we have to concentrate. Now, I realize we don't have jurisdiction to do things up there, but we certainly have the ability to bring pressure to bear on our Canadian neighbors. If we want to protect the right whales, we really got to focus on where the problem is. And it's not only gear, Jennifer. The biggest problem right now seems to be ship strikes. One of the problems with the right whale is that they tend to stay near the surface, and ship strikes are a big problem, particularly in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and Canadian waters. So, again, that's where I think we need to focus. But to your specific question, yes, of course, we're going to be working. Senator Collins is on the Appropriations Committee, and all of us will be working on, and as is Shelley Pingree, we're all going to be working on trying to have some compensation for the impact of this, which could be very substantial on on the industry. And by the way, I use the word, everybody uses the word industry. Lobstering in Maine is not really an industry. It's a whole lot of sole proprietors. It's
right.
A whole lot of very small businesses of individuals on boats. I think that's important to keep in mind. We're talking about thousands of families along the Maine coast.
And Senator King, I know you want to go, but Pat, you wanted to say something quickly, right?
Yeah, I just to drive the points home, I mean, there are 5,000 small businesses that are looking for certainty here. And even NOAA has said it within the biological opinion. We can have all the success in the world with the rules that they're trying to put forward. But if Canada does not address the issues around mortality and we continue to see stressors caused by ship strikes, the industry will never have certainty. There will always be more to come. And those are things that are outside of their control. The focus continues to be on this industry, an industry that's made sacrifices for two decades now. And at some point, that's got to stop.
Senator Angus King, thank you so much for calling in. And calling in now, Marissa Trago, who is the Atlantic Right Whale Take Reduction Team Coordinator with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, or NOAA. Thanks so much for joining in, Marissa.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process behind determining these new whale protection rules? The final set of rules took some people by surprise.
Sure. So we took a really multifaceted approach to develop these rules. So first, we started with a framework recommended by the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Team on how to achieve the amount of reduced risk that is needed, which largely relied on reducing the number and strength of lines across the Northeast. We then incorporated the use of a new model developed by the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, which allowed us to look at the relative risk reduction achieved by different types of measures and get an idea of the scope of actions that might be needed. So this model uses whale habitat density models from Duke University, a map of buoy lines from lobster gear in the Northeast, adapted from industrial economics, and gear strength information based on published research. So this allowed us to make evaluations of how likely we are to hit our risk reduction target and to identify hotspots where risk reduction or risk is aggregated enough to support the use of restricted areas.
So we then also took
into account.
Go ahead.
So we then also took into account additional whale distribution data and input from stakeholders to determine the approach that would achieve the, you know, minimum risk reduction target that was the most feasible and didn't have as disproportionate an impact on the fishery.
How confident are you that this area that was chosen in the Gulf of Maine is indeed what you call a hotspot, that this is indeed a place where right whales are at the most risk when they are traveling in the Gulf of Maine?
I am fairly confident. You know, we talk a lot about this issue being data poor, but we actually have quite a bit of data. We always could use more, but in fact, just 3 days ago, there was a pair of right whales that were moving near this offshore area through lobster buoy lines in offshore Maine waters. Obviously, this is something we will revisit if we need to, and with the more data we get, we can always refine our approach. But the data in our model is fairly clear that that is a potential hotspot. So we had to take precautionary measures.
Marissa, what do you say? You heard Senator King just now on the air, I'm sure. And we hear this from others as well, that this kind of measure does not really mean anything if the whales are going to move into Canadian waters and be hit by large ships. And if the crab fishery there doesn't have the same kind of regulations, sort of what's the point of damaging Maine's lobster fishery if these whales are going to be killed somewhere else?
Well, we are doing a lot of additional work that's beyond the scope of what I do. NOAA also is looking at the ship speed rules and such. That is outside of my purview. And we're also in bilateral talks with Canada. There's also an import rule that makes sure that we are only importing seafood from Canada if they can prove that their fisheries have a similar amount of risk reduction. So that is something that others are working on that's beyond the scope of what I do. That doesn't mean that we don't have risk in U.S. waters, including in Maine. So out of greater than 1,400 right whale entanglements that were analyzed by the New England Aquarium. We've only been able to determine a set about 15 times. We often don't get enough information to determine exactly where these incidents are occurring, but we know the incidents can occur anywhere there are buoy lines and whales that overlap. You know, we have to go based on the information we do know, based on how the population is doing. And we know that entanglements can occur anywhere.
So just to reduce risk
in our waters as well.
So just to be clear, Senator King said the last known entanglement in Maine waters was 2004. And what you're saying is that right whales have been found dead, clearly from an entanglement. And in most cases, we can't tell where they were entangled because, you know, there's not anything to indicate where the ropes that they are entangled in are from. I know before we let you go, Marissa, that Commissioner Kelleher would like to ask you a question. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, not so much as a question as a statement. I think, you know, we appreciate the data that that NOAA pulls together, and it's the same data that we analyze to prepare our comments. You know, there's a tremendous amount of assumptions that is made in this data, and those assumptions are really the ones that are become very difficult, right? The assumption of the 50-50 split between the U.S. and Canada, when it's clear that Canada has much more of an impact here, yet 50% of those are still attributed to the U.S. And then the whole issues of a closed area that we commented on, they could have very easily taken an approach of like Canada does, to use almost a dynamic management area approach, or to say, we're starting to see whales in these areas, we're going to close it the following year. But instead, there is a rush to close things, a rush to drive the ropeless process, which is not even close to being ready. So we still have a lot of concerns associated with the approach that the agency's taken. We'll continue to work with them cooperatively, but we're trying to find ways that we can have a better understanding of the data and the way this fishery works, because our concern still remains that the agency doesn't have a good grasp on how the fishery actually is operated.
And let me ask you that about that idea of a dynamic closure, Marissa. Why not go with that idea? Why did NOAA not choose to have the kind of closure where when we see right whales in an area, then we close an area? Why the just October to January, boom, closed?
That's a really good question. So right now we have a lot of process limitations that don't allow us to do that very quickly. Ideally, we could see a sighting and close the area immediately within that area with a slight lag for, you know, to allow fishermen to remove their lines. We have some limitations right now, but we're actually in the middle of a scoping process trying to get ideas on how we could potentially incorporate dynamic management in the future. So we're looking into this as an option. But there are a lot of issues. One of them is NEPA and things that require us to do additional environmental analyses that allow us not to act as nimbly as we would want to for such a dynamic management scenario. So this is something that we are considering. We just can't do very well at the moment.
Well, Marissa, thank you so much for calling in and being part of the program today. That's Marissa Trago, who coordinates NOAA's Atlantic Right Whale Take Reduction Team. We do need to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Panorama Organic, a U.S. producer of grass-finished beef and a proud partner of the National Audubon Society's Conservation Ranching Program, available at Hannaford, and by A Family for Me, a Spurwink program dedicated to finding families for Maine children in foster care. Learn more at afamilyformemaine.org.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, what the past can teach us about our water future.
For a long time, water was sort of unseen and not thought about. You know, everyone uses water, of course, but it wasn't thought of as something that we needed to prioritize and elevate and talk about.
Lessons from our water history, next on Climate One.
And you can hear Climate One this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. Balanced, in-depth coverage of local, state, and national politics is at the heart of public broadcasting, and keeping the electorate informed about the issues important to Maine is central to the mission of Maine Public. Maine Public's Political Pulse is a weekly discussion on the politics here at home with our chief political correspondent and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. The Pulse can be heard on Fridays during All Things Considered, and it's also available as a weekly podcast and newsletter at mainepublic.org. You can have the Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings by subscribing at mainepublic.org/pulse.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the difficult intersection of right whale protection and Maine's lobster fishery. My guest, Pat Kelleher, Commissioner of the Department of Marine Resources for the state of Maine. Share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now, Kristen Porter, who is president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Thanks so much for calling in, Kristen.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
Kristen, we heard Fred Bever at the beginning of the program talk about what fishermen in the Stonington area thought about the new regulations, and really kind of all over the map. What about what you're hearing from lobstermen in other parts of the state?
Well, it's just, I mean, there's a broad range for the two major things, or the three major things that have gone into effect. And the closure seems to be the biggest one for those guys affected by it, which is a terrible thing, only because of the fact that it really isn't going to do a lot for them, for the safety of right whales. Marissa alluded to risk reduction model. Well, that closure, the whole closure itself, was about 3% risk reduction for the whole state. And the Zone E portion, which is about 300 square miles, was 0.04%. So all those guys in 300 miles are reducing the risk of whales by 0.04%. So that's a pretty tough pill to swallow when you're on the water trying to make your living. And, you know, what's essentially going to happen, it's going to be a huge safety concern.
Yeah, so let me ask you a question, Kristen. If somebody looks at one of these maps that's been published that outlines the area that's going to be closed, you might say, wow, that really doesn't look like that big of an area, and it's pretty far offshore, and it's only 3 months a year. What kind of impact will that really have? It doesn't seem like that big of a deal, and don't most fishermen fish closer to shore anyway? Explain to us why, what kind of economic impact 3 months in a relatively, I mean, it's a large 1,000 square miles, obviously a large area, but compared to the Gulf of Maine, a small part of the Gulf of Maine, why is this such a big deal economically?
That type of time of year, actually, you know, guys who would be shifting gear there now from, you know, they fished inshore and they'd be shifting gear out into that area. So, because that's a very productive area in October, November, December, so those lobsters are migrating through there. That's why they're there, and that's they're to get that migration. Well, those guys that usually shift there, who are there now, are not going to take their gear out of the water. They're going to shift their gear close to that area, as close as they can. So in January, they can shift in there. Well, the gear density in those areas closest to that is going to be way thicker than it would have been otherwise. So really, you're adding to the danger to whales by more gear density surrounding the area. We call it like a fencing effect. So, and those lobsters in that area are going to keep migrating through. They didn't click free line with these large offshore boats. They will plaster the outside edge of that line, and they'll catch the lobsters on the migration, and those lobsters will still get caught. They'll just go to Massachusetts instead of the Maine fishermen that traditionally catch them.
Well, Kristen, thanks so much for calling in and explaining just a part of what the concerns of your organization. Kristen Porter, the president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. Pat, and I wanted to ask you economically, I understand that even though it is only 3 months of the year, that this part of the year accounts for a disproportionately large part of the economics of the lobster fishery in Maine, that a lot of these lobster are worth more, if you will, than the summer inshore lobster.
Yeah, we've talked to several fishermen who fish the predominant amount of their gear within that closed area. And they've told me that up to 50% of their income can come from that area from just those months. They depend on, their business model depends on that particular area. So certainly the closed area is going to have economic harm. The issues around gear marking and the timing of the rule for May 2022 is going to have, for all federal permit holders that are going to have to comply, where we've had some conversations with MLA and they did some additional analysis for us. And they're predicting that another 15 to 25 million in lost revenue is going to happen as they're trying to shift their gear over and become compliant for gear marking. So there's many components of this rule that's going to have economic ripples across the coast.
All right. And to clarify, not 3 months, 4 months, because it's all of October and all of January. I thought it was mid-October to mid-January. Okay. On the line with us now, Sean Mahoney, who is Director of Advocacy for Conservation Law Foundation. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's good to be here.
Much of what we've talked about is based on this premise that the Atlantic right whales require a great deal of protection. Tell us why that is.
Well, there's only 360 of them left on Earth, and that's down from 415 a few years ago. And so if we're going to keep these species from going extinct, we need to remove the cause of what's been killing them, and that's been ship collisions and entanglements with fishing gear, largely fishing gear that secures gear to the bottom. So it's either traps or pots for crab and lobster or gill nets. And so, action needs to be taken in order to prevent them from going extinct and to comply with the law, with the Endangered Species Act.
Do you think what NOAA has done is the right solution?
Well, we think some of it of what they've proposed is good. We think that we do think that the closure, which is of a relatively short duration, and which you were just talking with Pat and Tristan about, it certainly will have an economic impact on the folks who have fished there. But that's a relatively small number of people, about 60 people, that are going to have to move their traps, and that we recognize that's going to have an impact elsewhere. But it's an impact that we think is necessary because the government, the new rule sets a risk reduction target of 60%, even though the government has admitted that you need to reduce risk by 80% if you're going to keep right whales from going extinct. So the new rule doesn't set a risk reduction target high enough. And even if you're just talking 3% risk reduction, that's a significant amount when you're talking about only 380 whales, so 360 whales left.
Sean, it sounds like you're saying more needs to be done.
Well, we think that the at the end of the day, the conservation plan that's associated with this rule, which sets out a 10-year process in order to reach sustainability with the right whales, is not fast enough in order to head off, as I said, extinction. And as we all know, extinction is forever. And I think it would be it's really on all of us to make sure that this doesn't happen to this species.
Pat Kelleher.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing and what I continue to hear from the ENGOs on this issue is more needs to be done. Not enough has been done. It creates this whole level of uncertainty. It's a tough time to be a lobster fisherman in New England because the constant pressure from these folks in court, which has caused the state of Maine now to intervene in the case, just because we believe that there's going to be a big push for an immediate remedy outside of the regulatory process. So the state of Maine is going to be now has to engage in the court systems because the ENGOs are going to continue to try to resolve this through the courts instead of through the regulatory process. And it's just a, it's the focus of the fisheries that continues to be pushed. And again, even if we're successful, it doesn't mean there is going to be a recovery, right? We've got all these other outside factors, and they continue to focus strictly on the fisheries here, in particular in the state of Maine. We haven't had an entanglement in over two decades. We have done a lot. There's been a lot of sacrifices made, but they all want more. I don't know what this fishery is going to look like. It's going to have to be reinvented based on the pressures that the ENGOs are putting on the industry.
Yeah, and Sean, before I let you go, I'm going to go to one of our listener emails because I think this is something both you and Pat Kelleher can address. It's an email from David. He says, if ship strikes seem to cause the largest mortality in right whales, why is the federal government not enforcing rules requiring commercial ships to slow down to 10 knots? The rule is on the books. Why not enforce it and see if strikes go down? Sean, is that another part of the work that the Conservation Law Foundation and others are doing to try to get the speed of ships going through the Gulf of Maine and up? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Look, it's not all on one sector, and ship strikes are absolutely part of the problem. So is what's happening in Canadian waters. It's absolutely part of the problem, but it doesn't mean because there are other factors that you just ignore. You can just ignore one. The fact is that more than 80% of right whales have been entangled in fishing gear at one point or another, and it impacts their ability to grow, to procreate, and to survive. These creatures are dragging. When you get entangled with a rope, it's not like a piece of floss getting stuck in your teeth. You are the whale is dragging what's connected to that rope, which are long lines of traps, and doing it for hundreds of miles. It has an enormous impact on the health and the ability of the whale to survive. And I'd note, I think that the NGOs, and certainly my organization, Conservation Law Foundation, has been engaged with the state of Maine and the federal fisheries and other states in the Gulf of Maine to try and address this through rulemaking, to try and address it through regulations. And to the extent that the regulations meet the letter of the law, we're all for it. But if they can't meet the letter of the law by the regulatory agency's own admission, then those regulations aren't legal. They're not sufficient. And so the only alternative is to go to the courts and say, you've got to force these folks to do their job, which is to follow the law. And
Sean,
we appreciate what the commissioner is doing, what the agencies are doing, but we do. There does have to be more. We're going to watch these creatures go extinct.
We do need to go to another quick break. Sean Mahoney with the Conservation Law Foundation. Thanks for calling in.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from CEI Maine. From heritage industries to the next big idea, providing advice and capital to help businesses grow. Learn more at ceimaine.org. And by the Finance Authority of Maine, helping Maine people achieve their business and higher education goals since 1983. FAME Maine.
I'm Scott Tong. A Nashville dad says he enrolled his toddler in a COVID-19 vaccine trial after his other daughter benefited from trials of leukemia treatments.
Louise's treatment was discovered because people were willing to volunteer their children for trials.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. If you have an Alexa-powered device, like an Amazon Echo or a Google Home Smart Speaker, you can easily find Maine Public Radio whenever and wherever you'd like with a single command. Visit mainepublic.org for helpful tips on accessing Maine Public Radio on your voice-activated device.
And welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking about the tricky intersection between the impact of whale protection measures and the lobster fishery in Maine. With me for the hour, Department of Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. And calling in now, Amy Knowlton, who is senior scientist with the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium. Thanks for calling us, Amy.
Well, thanks for having me.
And you cite research that says there's a lot of inaccuracies regarding what does and doesn't harm right whales, a lot of myths out there. Tell us about those.
Well, one of the myths about the entanglement situation is that the information that's getting out there is only about the documented mortalities or the whales that have attached gear, which is a small subset of all the entanglements that these whales are enduring. We've documented over 1,600 entanglement interactions based on scars or attached gear, and only 130 of those have attached gear that might allow you to trace it back to where the entanglement occurred. But those other entanglements lead to severe injuries at times, and those can be fatal. You know, they lead to reduced health and can be fatal, and that's not being represented, I don't feel, in this conversation. Because we're trying to prevent those severe entanglements from occurring, from whales with attached gear from occurring. And so that's, I think, the biggest misconception about what's happening for these whales.
And when you say this conversation, you don't mean this conversation here on Maine Calling today, but you mean the broader conversation about this issue, right?
That's correct. And I apologize that I wasn't able to listen in to the earlier conversation today. But yes, the broader conversation that I've been hearing in the Maine in the news and from Maine DMR, I think is just not representing the full story of what's happening for right whales.
Well, up to this point in this hour, Amy, a lot of people have been talking about the sense that maybe Canada is not doing enough and that there isn't enough of enforcement on what's going on between ship strikes in the Canadian crab fishing industry. What do you say to that? Is there a way for you in the research you do to tell how much of these entanglements are lines from the lobster fishery in Maine or the fishery in Canada?
Well, we can tell that for a subset of the cases that occur in a given year, but certainly not all of them, because you have to have sighting before the event happened and after to sort of parse out where it might have occurred, or you have to have gear attached that can be linked back to a given fishery. So, for example, in our 2018 assessment, we have to go through every photograph to look for evidence of scars. And in 2018, we documented 59 entanglement events. 37 of those had minor injuries, and those we aren't terribly concerned about the effects on health for minor injuries, but 8 had moderate injuries and 14 had severe injuries. And those severely injured whales are the ones that are likely to die from those wounds. Only 5 of those had attached gear. So you can see there's a much deeper problem happening, and we can't always link it back to country. But we know Canada has certainly been trying to implement measures to address this. They've stated that they're going to be, that all their fisheries are going to be either ropeless or weak rope by 2023, I believe. And I think that's a really important statement that they've put forward. They have a mechanism to change their fisheries more quickly than we do here in the U.S. So they've been putting in emergency closures, dynamic closures, and they have really put a lot of effort into this up there. It's not solved the problem for sure, but it's certainly moving the needle in a better direction
Let's talk about that a little bit, because we've kind of touched on it a little bit before, but we haven't gotten there. This whole idea of the future of the industry and either weak rope or ropeless technology. Can you tell us in layman's terms, Amy, what you mean by that, how that works and how soon it might be able to be deployed realistically?
Sure. Yeah. Here in Massachusetts, we've done a lot of testing with fishermen for the weak rope side of things, which has been my focus. you know, we've learned from looking at assessed ropes from retrieved gear that rope strength, if it was dropped to 1,700-pound rope strength, would allow most large whales to break free from that gear before getting badly wrapped up and suffering severe wounds. We've had South Shore Lobster Fishermen's Association developed what's called a weak sleeve, where they can integrate weak points throughout the end line, and they've been integrating every 40 feet in the end line. Now the state is requiring every 60 feet in the state waters to insert a weak sleeve that would part at that 1,700-pound rope strength. And they're putting it throughout the entire end line, which I think is a really important point, that this final rule that NOAA put out is only requiring it for the top half or the top third of the end line. If a whale hits that end line below that point where the weak point is, it can still drown in that gear or suffer severe injuries. So that's our big concern about this.
Yeah, is the state or federal government helping lobstermen pay for the transition to this technology?
I know in the state of Massachusetts, they did support providing weak rope or weak sleeves to the fishermen as part of that effort here in Massachusetts. I don't know if the transition, as it's implemented more broadly, it should be subsidized, certainly, to go to ropeless, which is, you know, still expensive and needs to be ideally subsidized by the government or otherwise to help the fishing industry transition. The weak sleeves are not expensive at all. They cost about a dollar each. And, of course, there is a cost of time, labor to integrate, and just the cost of the sleeves themselves. But I do feel like that's something that could be implemented immediately and could have a real benefit as we get ropeless ideally implemented more broadly into closed areas and ideally into the offshore fishery where weak ropes may not be as feasible for them to use.
Commissioner Kelleher.
You know, there's an apple and orange conversation here between Massachusetts waters and Maine waters. It's very different. The depth of our waters, rocky bottoms, the tides, severe tides. So I want to make sure the listeners know that it's not a clear comparison between the two states and how the industries work. I want to give Amy a lot of compliments associated with a lot of the work she's done on the 1,700-pound breaking strength. It's work that Aaron Summers on my staff continues to strive for. We've NOAA supplied Maine DMR a rope breaking machine. We have worked tirelessly with industry, having them bring gear in so we could break that gear to see where it does break. We've developed different connections to ensure that their rope will break. And those are some of the things that have been implemented that we requested as some of our comments, actually. So I think it's really going to be a key to have weak rope, weak line in the water. It's going to be really critical. The sleeve is something that has not worked here in Maine. There are some fishermen in southern Maine that have tried it. It's been tried up and down the coast, but in many cases, because of the depth of water, you'll see fishermen using two different diameters of rope. And it may work on one side, but on the smaller diameter side, it's not working, it's not holding. So we're finding other ways to connect, as well as mechanical devices. There's been three mechanical devices that have been developed now that will break under pressure at or below that 1,700-pound line. So there's a lot of advancements there, and a lot of it's based on some of the work that that Amy did that has been peer reviewed and shown to work and around that 1,700-pound threshold. So we now need to figure out the transfer over to ropeless technology, but I can assure you that it's not ready for prime time. Some of the better studies have showed 75% success rates on retrievals. That means 25% of the gear is left on bottom, potentially lost, right? That's not, unless you can retrieve that gear 100% of the time, it doesn't work. And then people are forgetting about two other major components when it comes to ropeless. These are hurdles that need to be, we need to get over these hurdles. One being enforcement. Maine Marine Patrol hauls upwards of 20,000 traps a year for lobster conservation enforcement. We can't lose the ability to continue to manage lobsters while we're trying to save right whales. So we need to have the ability to haul that gear just as we would if there was an end line, and we need to resolve those particular problems. And then there's the mobile gear fleet, right? Not only do you have other lobstermen that need to know where that other gear is that's been set without end lines, where they would normally see and be able to tell where the gear is, now you need technology that should, that anybody out there, whether it's a dragger or another lobsterman, can look on a screen and say, okay, here's where all that gear is set. Here's the space I can set here. That does not exist yet. No way, shape, or form. The only technology right now is about a surface deployment, and it shows where it was set on the surface. If you're fishing in 90 fathom of water, that point on the surface is not the same point on the bottom. You're setting in a 4 to 5 knot tide. There's movement of that gear. So I'm not trying to be a roadblock to ropeless. I want to be proactive in the conversation, but it can only happen if we resolve all three of these items and not just one, which is getting a buoy to the top.
Well, I really want to appreciate you, Amy Knowlton, for calling in and sharing some of the research that you've been doing. I know that it's vast. And Pat Kelleher, I want to thank you for joining us for the hour. We're almost out of time, but we haven't even talked yet about the lawsuit that the state is involved in. So if you have a minute to sum up what the state is doing right now in terms of moving forward on this issue.
Yeah, I can't talk about the legal strategies associated with it, but first we have to intervene. And so that is what the law firm that we've hired is working on, a motion to intervene. We are hoping that that will be submitted as early as tomorrow, but Monday at the latest. Again, our concern, the big picture concern, is that if and Sean Mahoney touched upon a couple of points about the risk, the overall risk reduction in this 10-year horizon. They're obviously challenging those. We've seen the draft motions, and we don't want to be regulating this fishery in the courts, but we have to be prepared, and that's what the state of Maine, through the support of Governor Mills, is doing right now.
Well, Commissioner Kelleher, thank you so much for joining us. And to everybody who put in a question we didn't have time for, I apologize for that. Obviously, a very important and very heated issue here in the state of Maine. I want to refer you back to Fred Bever's reporting. He will continue to cover this issue on Maine Public Radio. His reports from Stonington probably rolling out next week, and continue to cover this issue from every side. Pat Kelleher, the Commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources. Today's sound engineer, KG Akeem Aladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Visit mainecalling.org to listen to past programs or to sign up for our podcast. Tomorrow, we will re-air our program about invasive plants and what to do about them. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.